The interview you're about to listen to was taped at North Dakota State University. It is of a teacher there, an art instructor, to be more specific, named Catherine Mulligan. She is a well-known sculptor and artist both locally and nationally, if not internationally. She's a very active person in the community, in art programs at Plains Art Museum, and she has been a resident of Fargo for a number of years. And during the interview, we discussed things such as folk art, symbols, how an artist may view the world, and her family background, which, remarkably enough, was derived from the original people who came over from the Mayflower. We discussed things such as students, how they're encouraged to learn art, how beginning artists, the troubles they face, what motivates them in the ways that they do, facing poverty and many things for a number of years. We discussed community reaction, and the interview was in a very relaxed atmosphere. It was in the classroom, but it was after class, and this was the second time that we had to do it. The first time we had technical difficulties, and nothing came of it. So a lot of what you're hearing this time was just a rehash of what was done before, a little bit. And I hope you will enjoy what you're about to hear. Okay, to begin with, why don't you tell me a little bit about your family background, where you're from, that type of thing.
Okay, originally I'm from Indiana. Two in the family. My father died when I was young, and just always worked hard for family survival. So we were a close family.
You're telling me earlier that your family is, your ancestors came over on the Mayflower?
Supposedly. Yes. Supposedly, we were original. The grandfathers fought in all the big wars, right? Mm-hmm. So moved across the prairie.
Kansas City?
My father was from Kansas City originally, and his ancestors came from Australia. On my mother's side, they supposedly settled from the beginning of the country and moved through to Indiana.
Okay, where did you get your educational training?
I got my undergraduate degree at Purdue University, my bachelor's, and got my master's at Morehead State University.
Now, what was your original degree in?
My original degree was in home economics. I got a scholarship, and that's what women did in the 1950s. They went into home economics.
Did you work for a time in that field at all?
I worked for a very small time for International Milling Company. I worked with a chemist and a baker, and we developed cake mixes and for Canada. We were the leading retailer in Canada through other brand names. So I worked for International Milling for a while. And then went to work at the University of Minnesota and worked in physics, which was a very exciting time. When I was at Purdue University, I tried to hide from home economics as much as possible, because with my father dying young, I spent so much time in pragmatic things, and I've always been very interested in ideas. So home economics was not that exciting to me. the professors weren't that exciting. So I found chemistry and philosophy and physics much more interesting. So I didn't stay in the field very long. Physics was very interesting. I started at the University of Minnesota working on that. We could get free tuition. But at the time, I was pregnant, so I couldn't stay awake in classes. So that was the end of that realm of research. And, but all my life, I've made art. So when I went back for my graduate degree, then I sort of fell into that. I just started making art beforehand. And I had moved to Moorhead, and I lived a couple blocks from the university. So I would walk over, and I'd pay 3 credits, and I would just make sculpture. And I said, "You're good, Catherine." And they made a degree program up for me, and that's how I got my master's at Moorhead State, because I knew I'd have to go out and make a living to support my children in college.
Oh, this was the first degree in art that they'd offered?
No, the first master's.
First master's program. Oh,
yeah.
I see.
Yeah. So we sort of built that program just because I needed credentials. And I also got another undergraduate degree in art then too, which just entailed a few education and human relations courses. So I picked up another undergraduate degree plus a master's. So I guess I have 2 undergraduate degrees, one from Purdue and one from Washington State.
Oh, tell me, when was the earliest time that you can remember becoming interested in art?
I guess I've always been interested in art. I think art chooses you. And coming from the background, I guess art was not a valid profession. We were very pragmatic people. So it took me a number of years to say I am an artist.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying something about your father collected old Indian relics and things on that order?
Yes, we had an Indian relic collection at home that he collected from all over the United States, and we were in the Tippecanoe Valley, and so he just had an eye, and he would walk across the fields and pick up. He was sort of a miscast farmer. His father died when he was very young, and he had joined the cavalry and traveled. And genetically speaking, coming through Australia and over here, I imagine his parents were adventurers and his forefathers were rich in ideas. One of his grandfathers, a couple generations back, was a superintendent of schools of New York City. And one was an itinerant minister working in Australia, one of the brothers. So he came from a very adventurous background. He, you know, wrote the American novel and all sorts of things while he was working during the Depression on my grandfather's farm, who were the farm settlers through the country.
When did they homestead?
I can't remember time, spaces, and stuff. So I don't know when the forefathers moved to Indiana. There was... my mother has all those records. They used to have flat books, and you'd pay so much money, and each year you'd get a gold-bound book with your family, your history in it.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like being Who's Who in North Dakota now, I guess. Let's see if they sell you a copy. So they have quite a few of those at home, but I've never really researched it.
Do these records, they still exist? Or you're saying something about a tornado that
took quite a bit of the stuff. Just took and plastered the fields with most of our things. One sea trunk was saved, and which had some of my father's things in, a little bit. And some things we had in another storage space that were not useful in a sense, but were very useful as far as history is concerned. So some of these things were sort of stored in an attic of my grandmother's house, so some of the things were saved. And the Indian relics were out, so we still have the Indian relics. So it seemed like the things of value, which again has a tendency to focus your value system, mm-hmm. were saved. But otherwise, everything just blew away. Mm-hmm. Nothing much. It was a hole in the ground. It took all the trees and Like right through. On power.
Well, you know, as you become an artist and become recognized in the community, what type of reactions has the community given? There's been a lot of artists, a lot of negative feedback.
Of being
the
outsider and not
outsider
fitting
and,
into the...
Yeah, you...
I guess I felt that as a human being, being oblique and not reacting to things like other people did, but I've always worked with culture and been totally integrated in culture. Now as an artist, I'll show at the Americana home, or I'll work with the special learning disability students, or I'll be on the State Arts Board, or I'll be on the museum board of directors, Lake Agassiz Arts Council, you know, been very instrumental in the community as far as building the recognition of art. And while I've been on the North Dakota State Arts Council, we've got the first grant for visual artists, which is pretty exciting. So I think one of the realms, because visual art seems relatively alien to spots of the country that have less communication with metropolitan centers, that you have to work with the people, you don't work against them. I think anything that one doesn't understand is a threat. I don't think people understand the art or artist as a useful realm in the culture. Intuitively, I think they know it, but they don't have the definitions. And I think in order for them to understand, one needs to not be embarrassed by who they are or by the definitions of art. So I don't think we need to, as artists, need to fear the culture. I think we need to talk to each other.
You think the artist reflects the culture somewhat, or is it...
Oh, you're always of your time and space. Art is always of the... if it's honest art, it is of the time and space. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you're reflective of your culture.
Okay, getting back a little bit towards making the public recognize art, or not making them recognize it.
But trying to communicate.
How important is that to get the public involved in art? Is that with you right now?
Yeah, I guess the only way I could say it is as an individual. It's the way I speak, and it's very important to me to communicate with my culture. I feel like I'm a valid member of culture, and I feel I have as much to say as attorney or the garbage collector or the housewife or whoever. I feel my statement is as important, and hopefully I'm cognizant of all the things that are going around me and dreams that people are wishing to fulfill, and I think that's exciting. So I don't neglect my culture at all. I'm always trying to figure out what's going on.
So the communication is very important.
And that's the way you communicate. If you're an artist, visually, usually verbally, you're not that astute, or some of us aren't. And you're not the best writer in the world, perhaps. So your primary research, your primary thought is in the visual pattern of what you see and how you can communicate those. And I think it's a valid form of communication.
So what is your reaction to, say, some hick out of Hicksville someplace that comes in and just absolutely will not look at the art, or will say it and say, well, that's a piece of crap.
My kid could do that, right?
Yeah.
I usually laugh. A sense of humor is very wonderful.
Yeah.
And then if I think he's working against the tension and the fear, I try to alleviate those fears. If I think he's just talking to himself, I just listen, and it doesn't scar me. That's where he is, and he's not ready to listen yet. Or that person is not ready to listen yet. So it's valid for him from his point of view where he is. You know, you always hope that he'll be touched someday. And his life will open, you know, to a broader perspective. That's what education is all about. It's hopefully opening new horizons and broader perspectives.
So, okay, well, what about folk art? Talking about education, educated art, but you've also got folk art, where this Hick coming out of nowhere. You know, he might be an artist himself, doing a very uneducated, unformalized style of art.
And he may be very good, and if he is, or the person is, I will tell them, you know, how excited I am about their work. One doesn't have to be academically trained to be good. If one visually perceives pattern, and many folk artists looked at good art, we weren't culturally created in a vacuum. I almost have this thought that art could even be genetically programmed, right? That somehow that information is already in the individual. And many folk artists who weren't academically trained have spent a good deal of time looking at the balance of nature, being very open to the balance of nature. I guess maybe the biggest thing about being an artist is to be open and to try to interpret honestly. And many folk artists have wonderful abilities to do this. Sometimes it's more magic than the fine arts or the academically trained artist in that sense. I just went down to the folk art show at the university, or at the Minneapolis Institute of Art, and there was a Amish quilt on the wall, and from the same perspective, I could see a Frank Stella painting, 20th century American painter, and the quilt walked right off the wall and had more about formal art integrated into its designs and patterns than the Frank Stella. I mean, it was exciting, you know, to see them in that juxtaposition. Can be just as honest and just as revealing and just as beautiful and just as a rewarding experience for the viewer as and the mind and the soul as an academically trained artist.
So it's the communication.
Right.
Back
right.
to the communication.
Right. Within that realm, there's always that thought of how much is our taste trained, right? Maybe, again, the artist sometimes has the inability to look at something because he hasn't seen it before, or he's formed a closure on seeing that thing. And we've seen that all through ages, of rejections of different kinds of arts and not understanding the new arts. But hopefully the master artist just sees what he sees and does what he does. And it's so honest that time will validate it, even if it's not in his life realm. But a larger time space will validate it. And it will be preserved for our perspective as the visual artist.
So this observing as an artist, observing other works of art, important.
It is for me. It is for me. I'm academically trained. Mm-hmm. Maybe for the naive artist, maybe he's just observing nature and going direct. Mm-hmm. Or in today's age, many naive artists are still seeing very good things. They have good books, right? They have television. They have galleries they're going into. I guess the sad part of that is when you get a lot of Sunday artists or Sunday painters in there that are doing the facade and doing it for other kinds of approval, they have a tendency to water down. I've jurored art shows in smaller communities, and more often the naive art is better than that which is labeled professional if they have, you know, different groupings. because one will think they're professional and they're just sort of covering the facade. They really don't have a statement, or they, you know, have not looked in depth. And even in larger areas, you'll find this life that is very popular at the time and has been pushed by the critic and the media, 10 years later will be totally negated because it didn't have that strength of the decisive courage that real art has. It's just sort of flat or periphery statement.
That's interesting. So, you're saying that there's a very great difference between, or that there may not be a very much of a difference between formalistic type training of art and very simple art. Say, what about, you know, you're saying, well, you know, this is still America that you might be referring to, but what about getting into primitive art, Eskimo art, things of that sort?
It's the same thing, I think, as the naive artist. Again, it's that direct communication with one's culture, you know, really being open. The five senses are really open, they're really perceiving. And this person just conceptualizes it right, and he does it. It's the honest thing for him to do, and so he does it. It's just sometimes it gets watered down when one gets kind of halfway in between definition, say, of the academically trained and the one who is honestly responding, you know, to his environment. The Eskimo sculptor, it's a heritage. Sometimes they're as well or better trained than our academic artists because that's what they do, right? Their forefathers taught them how to do it. And perhaps it was even more important to their culture than art is to, say, 20th century American culture, because it was a part of the magic of their culture, right? They might have even been the shaman or the magic man of their culture, interpreting the meaning of life, and the meaning of health, and the meaning of life, and the meaning of death for their people. And so this was a heavy responsibility and a very heavy communication. This was hope. This was faith, and this was very many of these kinds of spiritual definitions we talk about. Even today, you'll read a statement by a juror, right, say the Whitney Biennial, and the juror will come out and say, you know, I'm looking for the magic in the art. You know, there'll be a lot of good academic trained art presented, but they're looking for the magic or the communication.
So this is what all artists face, no matter what setting they're in.
Right, right. Everyone who goes through the activity of making art, you know, I'm sure there's bad Eskimo sculptors and good Eskimo sculptors, and there's probably more bad Eskimo sculptors now than there were, say, 50 years ago, because the Eskimo is going in through a transition now because their art is becoming commercialized. I was in a gallery in Winnipeg, and like when the Eskimo artist comes in, they take the price off of the art, right? Because they paid the Eskimo so little, and he wouldn't really understand what a light bill was or a rent bill was or this type of thing. So again, we're starting to water down maybe the purpose of the art, you know, how we're even communicating as, say, a cultural gallery dealer with that artist. So maybe he just starts producing. We particularly did that in Alaska when the tourists started buying the seal. You know, they'd tell the Eskimo he would need the cookies, right? Mm-hmm. So they'd tell him, you know, give me 50 seals. All right, it wasn't the one magic seal, right? He'd say, I'll give this guy what he wants. He's giving me the cookie, I'll make him 50 seals, you know. And maybe some of the spirit went out of the artist when he was working. One exciting thing about America, American art, and when we speak of academia and when we speak of the naive artist, is the idea of, but so long it seemed to me there was so much ugly art in America, and America had such poor taste, and it was, you know, kind of an ugly place to be at times. And then all of a sudden I came to the realization that one of America's definitions is just the raw courage that we have the right to do it, if that makes sense. So there is something very exciting about not having all those definitions, not having to do it like our father did it, not having to do it like our grandfather did it. In very few cases, our mother or our grandfather, father, historically, right, just by definition, and we could make our... but anyway, because America didn't appeal to rules, but did go across the prairie and grab and take and settle and all these things, I think we've had more raw edges in America. And these are kind of exciting. I think these are very exciting. Maybe in Japan, we might find a more well-crafted piece, right? But again, because of the generational thing and not having a definite purpose for that art in the mind of the artist, you know, it might become slick, well-crafted, and again, lose the spirit. So within that, I think as an artist, you're always just trying to find that zinger that goes right straight to your soul.
How does one set up a communication with your soul?
I don't know if you're born with it, or it's just the most important thing in your life. You know, there's always that fear, it's the drive that keeps you going, it's never good enough, right? So you just keep trying to give it life. It's like, you know, you keep sending it out, and it might not have the life you want to give it, but as Matisse says, I enter through the weakness of that last piece, and you keep trying to say it, you know, more strongly. It might be a whisper, but you want to say it more strongly. I don't know, it keeps you going.
Well, when you're working with, or say, think back to when you were just starting to draw pretty much and this type of thing.
I think that was just an activity that you had to do. I mean, you know, when you're young, you don't think you're going to do any earth-shaking work. And I think as a mature artist, you don't maybe think you are too, because you're not a missionary out there. You're not too, you know, out to make everybody think like you do. Maybe you're just out to say every statement's important. And you try to make it important, right? If it's important for you, hopefully it will be important to the viewer. So I don't know. I guess that's what keeps you going. You start with the activity, and the activity takes you over, and the activity becomes your mind. The activity becomes your success for yourself as a human being. Your activity becomes a way of talking to yourself. You know, it's like, as the artist, maybe you feel so intently, and you have so many raw edges that are perceiving so intensely that verbally, you don't know the structure to say it so the other person will listen. You know, structurally you don't know how to write it, so you feel it's said. So if you try to do it that way, you just sort of push everybody away from you, right? But somehow maybe if you are a visual artist and you found medias that you speak through, it's something anyone can come in and partake of or leave or go as deeply into your statement as they wish to do. And so you keep your even pace within the culture.
You both draw and also you're a sculptor.
Yeah, I paint, I printmake, I try it all. I only exhibit sculpture though.
Which did you begin?
I began painting and drawing. I suppose I started drawing first, and then I started painting, and kept a livelihood with that. I was doing a lot of research, but it seemed that I just wanted to move that actual thing in space. It was just more reality to me with the sculpture and more strength than there was with the painting. And I think I'd lose my place. I lose my place in a painting, or I lose my place in printmaking. I'm dyslexic. So it's like by the time I keep moving it around and I keep losing my place so much, that the sculpture is there and it's solid, and I can keep my place better where I am. Strange.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine too. Yeah. Okay.
I like sculptures better too than the ones I know. It seems like again, maybe coming from the rural background and coming from very honest, direct survival people, maybe there was so many words going around the painting. And so many illusions that I wanted a more direct statement. Mm-hmm. You know, it seemed more honest, maybe just personal. Mm-hmm. Although I love the color, and that's why I started painting, but I found some medias in sculpture and started painting on sculpture and stuff, so I integrated the structure to the color.
How do you choose a medium?
By your statement. You know, you just have empathy into certain things that make the statement that you wish to make. And to me, the material isn't important. You know, I don't even like researching materials. I mean, that's not my kick, building a studio or... Studio really isn't the important thing to me. The statement, the piece, is the important thing. So many times I get things out of the material that one wouldn't ordinarily get if they knew the rules. Mm-hmm. I'm always breaking rules on materials because I see the statement and I see what a material will do visually. And so I try to put those two together. I really believe in the marriage of science and the arts. Coming out of Purdue University, one could hardly think otherwise, and being as interested in physics as I am. But I don't let the science rule me in that sense. You know, I try to find more out about it. I just don't want the information that the people are giving me. And so that's always kind of an openness over there. My materials are always open. If I find a new one tomorrow that's better than the one I use today, I'm not married to any material.
So. I heard you use the term vocabulary before when you're referring to art. Could you explain that a little bit more?
I think every field has their own vocabulary, and it's the way we communicate, particularly if we're going to teach in academia, and particularly if we're going to communicate with our fellow artists. I would probably communicate differently with the Eskimo than I would with, say, the chairman of the department at Wisconsin University, right? University of Wisconsin. So. But it is the way we speak to each other, and it's the way we get excited, and it's the way we don't feel isolated. You know, the art is enough, but we are very social animals. So we try to communicate and form shortcuts for people to see. I think you learn to see. And you can learn yourself, yeah. You can learn as anyone, you can learn yourself and you can learn in your mind. But if you have a student paying so many dollars and you have, say, 9 weeks with him, I mean, you want to speed that seeing up. And so if you can teach him a quick vocabulary in which you can communicate, the more one-word vocabulary can do, right, the more we see and the more we can communicate, and the more we can get on to the next point of seeing and the next point of seeing. And a lot of this is through the history of art. So if I say Matisse, you and I have already set up a means of communication. Right? If I say Brancusi, already we've
set up a means of, we'd be room. The more research each one of us have done, the more museums we have been to already, we've set up something. And we can just look at each other and have insight, particularly if we're looking at that student's piece or that other artist's piece, and we look at each other and it's there. And in the same way, if you go to major museums, you see where the artists are all talking to each other with visual symbols and visual languages, and we can interpret that down to shape of edge, value of edge, structure of the picture, what's an oblique line do as opposed to a vertical line. I mean, we can start bringing it into the realm of a very formalistic language, as well as a very abstract, all-encompassing language.
Are you familiar with Steve and I, leave artists? We talk to many type of artists, how they might learn, how they just compare. This is describing formalistic training.
Well, usually with a more naive artist, you'll go on a more narrative basis and then give them a technique to do it. For instance, you might say a lighter red might work there. You wouldn't go into value and warm and cool colors and this type of thing. You just say, maybe a light red, maybe toward the yellow, might work better in that space. In the university, usually we try to teach a very conceptual vocabulary so the student can plug as many questions when he gives his own critique of it as his drawing when he steps back from it. We try to give him as broad a conceptual vocabulary as we can, whereas if I'm out juring and people come and want to talk about their painting, it'll probably be in a more narrative manner. Of just color, whether it be lighter or darker. You know, we wouldn't even say value. We wouldn't say tint and tone. We would just say, why don't you lighten that red a little bit? You think I'd push that gray back a little bit for you? Would it look like you were over the hill?
Okay, you said something earlier, the other day, about that's why I brought up that
one. I suppose part of that came out of having the Indian relics around all the time. As kids, we just played with them. They were toys, right? They weren't precious objects. They're very durable, and they were meant to be used, right? They were the pipes that were fetish pipes, and they were the points and everything. And these were very useful things for the culture. And so they were meant to be handled. All my life I played with them, dusted them, whatever. I guess I've always been around art. And then as the educator and as a member of the community, I'd like to encourage young artists that when I have money or if I think a person has done a very good piece of work, if I can afford it, I try to buy it just as saying, I wish to encourage you. I think you're good. I think our culture puts value on money, and we are a member of the culture. And we have a tendency, when we're young, before we find out that art is its own value and its own life, and who can own a piece of art. No one thinks of the Pietà of Michelangelo being owned. You know, it might pass through a few different places, but it does have its own life. But when you're very young, I think it's, if somebody thinks enough of you to pay you $50 for a painting, right, it helps you understand maybe why David Hockney might be getting $60,000 for a drawing, right? That there is a value in this culture, and culture is seeing you as some kind of value. As I say, by the time you make a declaration in your own soul that you're an artist, I mean, money can be all of it. Because culture, hasn't really come to grips with that kind of definition of the artist. It's not like, you know, I give you a tonsillectomy for so many $100 and a room for so many $100. I mean, they haven't come to terms with what does your education mean, what does your studio mean, you know, what does your time, what does what you have accumulated over time, space, and in your mind and in your profession. They have not come to terms with evaluation on that. It's more like football, superstar. The superstars get paid, and the periphery artists generally do not. And we're all a part of the fabric. I think we're all important. Whether we reach the realm of a de Kooning or a Chagall who's 97 now, and whether we're rewarded, or say a Henry Moore who gets most of the commissions and architectures, whether we're rewarded within the same realm, they have not come to terms with anything in the fabric of how they would pay, you know, the emerging artist or the mature artist or whatever. Jim Dine said that when he first broke through in the Happenings, and that was a big superstar thing, right? You know, like being the quarterback on the best football team and whatever the league sucks. He said it was very difficult for me to realize I could get this remuneration where my educator, who could paint very well, right, was getting nothing. And it was really hard. So he said, I had to learn to paint. So it's the fabric of our culture, but it's, as I say, America has courage, and so I accept this in America. Once I came to terms with our courage, that we can have a definition, or we don't have to have one, or we can make a definition, I don't worry about remuneration. I don't think money is the fabric of success. You know, it's nice to have money, but you can be successful as an artist without it. You can be successful for yourself, and your art can be successful. You know, and masters are not always paid. Masters don't always get through academia. We have other slots, and we put different goals of what's important. And thus far, artists have not put money as one of their goals. It's not to say that 3 decades down they won't. I mean, some professions, such as medicine, who started out very humanistic and very integral to the culture, now are getting big remuneration in that sense as an overall field, more as an overall pattern. Whereas artists who kind of have a star, and then other people who happen to make art, or the naive who generally doesn't get anything, who is making just wonderful, wonderful statements.
Okay, well, how would you become how did you become established?
You just make art, and there always seems to be enough people around to encourage you, right? They don't understand you, but they encourage you. For instance, when I went to school, my daughter just told me that my mother said I was the only one out of my brother was younger or was older and didn't go to college, right? So my mother said we sent Catherine to college because we didn't know what to do with her, right? So already they knew.
Yeah.
You know, working in the general store was not going to be fulfilling, or raising, you know, 3 children, and that would be it. That would not be enough for us. So that was an insight. Already there was a great encouragement. To this day, my mother doesn't understand what I'm doing. You know, as far as being an artist is concerned, she understands that I teach at a university, that I have many young people around, and she understands all these things. But she doesn't understand what being an artist is, and yet she accepts the fact that some people do that, and that's what they do. So that was the initial encouragement. And then when I met other artists, they were very, very encouraging. And it was very difficult to show art in the public realm, because if you are an artist, it's so important to you, you don't want to pollute, right? You don't want to, you know, your objective is not to get your art out front to communicate, because you think other people are communicating better, you know, in that sense. and you don't want to make their state less. So, but I always receive so much encouragement from other artists and from juried exhibitions and these types of things that, it's what the heck, I'll put it out, because you're screaming to communicate. So with me, an exhibition is a high, and also it's a depressing time, because you have that fear that you're not good enough, that you haven't paid a deep enough price, but it's so important.
Do you think it's important for an artist to suffer or feel a price?
I think you have to live, but I don't think you necessarily have to suffer, but you have to be honest, and sometimes it's very difficult to be honest. It's much easier to try to be like everyone else, and it's much easier to say what the other person wants to hear, and it's much, much easier to be nice than it is to be meaningful. And at some point in my life I said, I want to be not benign in a sense, but I want to be meaningful. Nice is not enough. Nice people send you out to get killed. Because they haven't cared enough really to say the honest, direct thing.
So the honesty is very important.
Oh sure, go out in front of that car if you want to, right? Go off to that war if you want to. It's easier to do that sometimes than to think things through and to say what you truly believe. And I think you have to practice at that kind of directness. But I think only through that directness can you be honest. If it's not honest for you, how can it be honest for who you're speaking to? You've just got two watered down communications, and you might as well not spend the time talking. There's enough, of the soft stab going around.
So you're saying,
deluding ourselves.
So you're saying that it's not only very important to communicate, but also to make a statement?
I think any artist is making a statement of, hey, look. Look. I don't think they're necessarily like, if you're pointing to saying, is it always a social statement in the realm
that's
of,
more right.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think just reiterating the universe is a strong statement, not saying that a particular thing of don't throw that oil in that specific ocean. I think if we see the beauty of a rhythm of the universe, I think we'll be bright enough not to put that oil in that ocean, or to make enough protective measures that it would very seldom happen. I mean, we'd weigh our values much strongly, so I don't think they're direct social statements. But I think the humanity,
this
the
is
visual
for you,
art,
is it?
Yeah, for me.
Some artists will make a direct statement.
And usually, universality goes stronger than specifics, as far as total understandings and building the human character. If we take information outside the realm of understanding, it means little. So I don't pollute this lake, so I burn down this forest on purpose. You didn't tell me that I shouldn't burn the forest, you just told me that I shouldn't pollute the lake or the ocean. So I think a universal understanding is in artist's work as well as specific social. And I think the universal probably lasts longer and is stronger.
How is this type of an idea developed with you? So you always felt this all the way from the beginning of your art, or is it something that's...
Probably old age. They say if we waited for everyone over to 30 to get things done, maybe they wouldn't get done, because I think as we gain maturity, as we hopefully gain wisdom, we become less judgmental, we become less specific. And hopefully we do become more universal and have broader perspectives and have more understanding and have more empathy. And just through that ambient life and that ambient statement around us, that a greater truth will come through than, don't go out in the street. Maybe you could go out in the street if there's not a cop. There's a lot of exceptions, and if one has understanding, they can make decisions and choices, whereas if one just has a rule, it limits them. Why the rule?
I see. Okay. You have, what, 3 children, am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
All right. In raising your children, how important was it to you, or was it important at all in teaching them art, or what role did that play? Did you teach them at all or push them into it?
They probably know more about art than most university students, although they don't go in the direction of art. I mean, they've lived an art life. And probably the youngest the most, because the more you go into something, the more your environment of friends, and the more the conversation. So they all have good taste, they all have good eyes, and they're all very supportive and very helpful. But no, I didn't teach them art, they lived art.
See, your husband now, what does he do?
He owns an off-sale liquor store.
Oh, I see.
His family store.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, he was...
Was he ever an artist, or was he...
No, he came out of history and economics. He's a federal bank exam before he built his own business. He's very interested in writing and history. Mm-hmm. He does some publishing, just local things. He's a naive writer in the sense of, the storytelling.
Any of your children, they're not going into art at all, is it?
My younger, Mike, she takes an art class every quarter. She's at Stanford University, just studying under Oliveira. But she says it's too hard. But I imagine she'll always make art. She's always seen all my poor friends, right? And trying to struggle with their cyclic living of survival, particularly the young artists. And she's seen them sacrifice, some of them that are trying to make it, not raising families and not getting married and these kinds of things, just because financially it wasn't feasible. And she says she'd like to go out, and she's very young, she'd like to go out and support artists by art.
I see.
But I don't know what field she'll go. Stanford believes in an education instead of a vocation.
Mm-hmm. Why would you, why do you think that artists are driven so to be poor?
Because culture doesn't pay them. I don't think they're driven to be poor. I don't think anybody's driven to be poor. It's easier to be unhappy rich than it is to be unhappy poor. But I stand to that. You know, I don't think money is really the criterion. I think it's cultural. It has not seen fit to weave the artist within the financial fabric, and that's not the artist's goal. Maybe there'll be enough arts administrators now, the way there are, hospital administrators, that will be woven in the fabric. I don't think it's a choice of the artist, except that they didn't set out to make money, and ideas, probably the last thing someone will buy. You know, the philosopher, right? Usually culture takes care of these people because it is the culture, right? We pay the philosopher to think, right? If he's great enough and he writes, somehow culture finds a way to pay the great philosopher, the great artist. put in. I don't know how they pay the philosophers that aren't great, probably teach the way I do.
So why did you have to make great sacrifices early on as an artist, in a sense, struggling financially?
I've never had money, you know, but what money I do, I put into IBM, the supportive idea. But I don't have a heavy, I've never developed a heavy needs system because I've never had it. I mean, like, I would rather buy a piece of art than a couch. And sit on the floor. That's my choice. So I say, look at my wonderful art. I don't apologize that I don't have a couch. Because a couch seems unimportant if one would have the choice of feeding one's soul and, you know, having a soft seat for their ass. The mind is more important at that point, right? Because the floor suffices. But if I had to make a choice, you know, between having a home over my head and a piece of art, of course I'd make the house payment, you know. Because I could go to the museum and see the art. But I wouldn't be encouraging the sort of artist. So it's just a matter of what you have and what, you know, what value system you've built for yourself. Before, I suppose, if you want to go back to the tribal living, right, say the magic shaman worked his magic, made his images, and culture brought him food, right? Culture brought him food. So it's just working those systems out. But there's no anger. Maybe it weeds out to a certain extent, maybe the magic people who are really meant to make art, maybe they're the ones that survive, you know. Maybe that's the important fabric for them. And maybe, you know, luck is important, right? Encouragement is important. Support systems are important. You know, you don't know who you lose and who goes forward. But life's not fair. I don't know those definitions. So, but it hasn't played an important role in my life. I guess the ultimate would be that I never starved. I've never seen every museum I would like to see. I've never seen every masterwork of art I would like to see. But I have not starved. And I've never, you know, gone without the shelter.
Okay, you talked about encouraging, you know, artists to have a certain amount of talent or to see something there. What do you say to the artist who says, well, I can't go into art because I don't want to start? What if they have this?
Then I say, don't go into art. You know.
So it's not a real strong...
You only go into art if that's who you are and that's what you do. But I think as a social animal, we need encouragement of what we do is good. Particularly if it's important to us. We need someone that we respect and love that somehow communicates to us. I don't think we're meant to be isolated in a dark hole with no communication. I think culturally we're a network, and if we see something that's exciting or we like something about another human being, I think we communicate that. But still, it's up to that individual to make that choice. We have no guarantee that if you go into art, that you're going to make the living that you think that you need. But if you are an artist, you somehow go into that profession, and somehow you work at whatever jobs you need to survive. It just depends on how strong the thrust is, and maybe how much encouragement you get. But I never tell anyone, don't go into art, you're going to be poor. You might go into art and be a superstar. It's like 20 years ago, you wouldn't have sent someone to college, right, to get a degree in basketball. And yet a basketball player could probably make, if he's a superstar, make enough money in 5 years to last him for 5 lifetimes.
That's right.
I don't ever discourage anyone from doing anything that seemingly that's who they are. I'm not an administrator that says you go into museum work, you go into art history. Van Gogh had no facility, supposedly, as being an artist. Van Gogh was supported by his brother. And yet Van Gogh is one of our natural resources, one of our cultural resources that we would be less than had we not had.
Okay, one last question. How do you see art in the future? I said it was ugly for so many years. How is it going? Is it becoming more diverse, or is it becoming simpler?
Well, they have all kinds of cliches. The critics give us right now, they say it's an eclectic period. It's a neo-expressionist period, and they say it's a bad art and it's ugly art, right? But that's a reflection of our culture. I was just over at Moon reading a critique on the Max Beckman show, who was a more or less black painter coming out of sort of like Guernica, Picasso's, when the town in Spain was bombed and women and children were killed. Time will tell. Time will tell. You can only have your own vision. I don't have, in that sense, predictions of what direction it will take. But there will be those magic spots in culture where ideas will generate and brainstorm and exciting things will come out. Usually there's the one isolated artist who makes particularly strong statements but is aware of everything going on. And other times there's groups of artists where a number of them interact with each other and push each other. Strong new ideas come forth. There is a continuance of the history of art. It's wonderful. It just builds, you know, like the ocean waves build. The art just builds. Sometimes it's calm and not too much happening, and a wind comes up, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful. But the struggle is always there. And you always hope that the insights will be there. And the experiences will be thus, and you'll have the knowledge that if you're in that magic spot at that time, that the statement will get better, and you will be a part of that continuum for history. If you're not, you still serve the useful purpose. Because you've done what's honest for you. And that can't be wrong for culture.
Hey, well, thank you.